You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, March 16th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Happy day after the Ides of March, everyone.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Yes.
Sure. If you want that, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah. If that's what you know.
I like the Ides of March
from Rome yesterday.
Is one of my favorite days of the year.
No, it's not.
Really?
Why?
It is.
Wow, that's a
what do you do to sell? What do you do to celebrate?
Because March is the transition from winter to spring, and the middle of the month is the halfway point. So we're basically into spring now, even though spring's still a week away.
Okay. It has a groundhog-ish theme sort of to it in a way, but
that's
okay.
Not even in my top five.
Yeah, why would that be your favorite? Couldn't just like the equinox be your favorite then?
Oh yeah, yeah. But we're almost at the equinox. That's the point.
I see.
Kara, everybody celebrates the equinox.
No, mentally for me.
Not everyone celebrates the Ides of March.
March is always that transition. And to put a point on this, earlier this week, before the Ides of March, we had the worst winter storm of the year week. And today, it's 60 degrees in spring like. So there you go.
Right.
Oh,
the worst wasn't that bad at all.
But it was still the worst.
Exactly.
The first time we had any significant snow on the ground was this weekend. It's already gone. It's melted. It's beautiful out. Spring.
Beautiful.
The Ides of March.
Beautiful.
It's beautiful. Oh, okay. Two things. One, just saw a pretty interesting news alert, reading it as I talk, so bear with me, that there's some new evidence, and this Catherine Wu of The Atlantic says the strongest evidence yet, that an animal started the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So there's new genetic samples from China, from Wuhan, from that market, that appear to link the early COVID genes to raccoon dogs. Mm-hmm. Do you guys know about raccoon dogs?
I'm just learning about their existence, which shocks me. It's amazing. They look
Is that like Texarkana?
They look like raccoons and dogs.
Yeah, they do. They really do look like raccoon dogs. That's the perfect name for them.
It's a hybrid.
They're really cute, but apparently they were also being illegally sold at the market, and they may have been shedding the virus. I don't know. There's obviously we got to dig more into this, but it kind of coming on the heels of all this conversation about lab leak. And, you know, it's just so fascinating that now 3 years into the pandemic, we're still discovering new things about how it started. I personally only just now got COVID, which is fascinating to me as well. I'm on the tail end of it, feeling better. It lasted 3 days. It was amazing. I started testing positive Wednesday night. I got symptoms Wednesday morning, maybe even Tuesday night. Tested positive Wednesday night, took Paxlovid the minute I had a positive test, was negative by Saturday. I was negative before I finished my Paxlovid, which was Monday.
Wow. Interesting.
That's really powerful stuff, man.
Yeah. I also think that whatever strain this is just a quick and dirty. Like, it didn't make me that sick. Granted, I'm like fully vaccinated and boosted, but a lot of other people I know who had it were also not that sick, but they're all vaccinated too. But it was like kind of quick, just feels like a cold. But something else that I find really fascinating is that, you know, in my sickiness, I watched The Last of Us and I'm sort of obsessed.
That's awesome.
Speaking
it's a fantastic show.
It's so good, Bob.
Oh my God. So many levels.
So many. Like, and you know, I could kind of care less about like the zombie component of it, even though I get it. But to me, that's the background, you know?
You're right. It's like total background.
That's the vehicle.
Yeah, it is. It's a nice background.
It is. It works.
But it's a background.
But like, and of course, I didn't play the video game. I don't, you know, I didn't already know about the lore. But the story and the psychology behind the story, I love when something is ostensibly like a fun, you know, zombie or like horror or suspense kind of show, but really at its depth, it's a deep question about
where are you in the series?
Oh, I finished it.
Oh yeah. We did a full review on AQ6. It was glowing reviews all around. It was really the character development and everything was fantastic. Definitely recommend it. But getting back to the raccoon dog though, I just want to talk about because this is, you know, we've been following the lab leak theory both here and on science-based medicine, you know, since the beginning of the pandemic. And it's interesting, this is, you know, exploding again. What's interesting is that you have like the two communities are, which take their different approach to the question, are getting so polarized. Like they're both now entrenching, if anything. So essentially, you could take two approaches to the question of where did the virus come from. There's the scientific approach, or the epidemiology, virology approach, right? Which is to say, what does the virus look like? What does it look similar to? What's the epidemiology of the early detections of the virus? And then the other approach is the investigatory approach, which is just what happened in that part of the world at the time. So, you know, recently the FBI and the Department of Defense both came out saying, yeah, we're pretty sure that the Chinese did this, right? That it was leaked from a lab and they were responsible and they're covering it up. But we can't tell you why we think that. It's secret, you know, but we're...
Yeah, that's really helpful.
Trust us. We're really sure about this. The scientists, on the other hand, are going, no, that's not what the scientific evidence shows. It shows the epidemiology. It zeroes in on the Wuhan wet market. This is an animal spillover. There's no signs of engineering. That's one thing. That's why they had to back off from the engineered virus to the lab leak virus, because there's no evidence that it was engineered. Saying, okay, it's a natural virus. It just accidentally got out of the lab. Therefore, we could avoid the evidence from virology. But the epidemiological evidence still points to, no, it was a spillover from the wet market. So this new little piece of evidence is huge.
Because right,
now
they didn't have that before.
The one thing we didn't have was the animal of origin. If they're saying that they have connections between the virus and viruses in raccoon dogs, that's the last piece.
It's an
international team of virologists, genomicists, and evolutionary biologists. So a big collaboration.
Okay, so it's not the...
It's
not the Chinese government.
No.
This is international collaboration of individuals basically saying that exactly what Steve said, like everything pointed to the fact that this basically wholesale seafood market seemed like the origin, but nobody could point to the actual genetic data saying this is the animal that it came from. And now they've basically said, okay, looking at these sequences, the raccoon dogs that were being sold there could have been carrying and shedding the virus in that site at that time.
And how will they be able to confirm this for sure?
I don't know if we'll fully confirm it.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the past, right? But all the epidemiological, virological data is pointing to the wet market. And now we have one more layer of detail, a possible species of origin. You know, we're getting closer to the viruses of origin. This is as close to a smoking gun, I think, as we're going to get, again, scientifically. It just doesn't jibe with the lab leak theory. And I think my sense is that the investigators, right, not the scientists, but the government people, they're basing their opinion on the fact that China is hiding something.
China's not been very forthcoming.
It's not a compelling argument that there was a lab leak. Because remember, Evan, that China's position is that the virus came from outside of China. They're not saying it came from the wet market in Wuhan. They're saying it was some other country that imported it with frozen meats. It wasn't even China's fault. So they don't like either of the theories, right? And so they are being squirrely. They are hiding things, but that doesn't mean that doesn't support the lab leak theory per se, because they would also do that to try to deflect interest from the Wuhan wet market theory.
Right. But unfortunately, we have swabs. There are swabs of the wet market around when we know the pandemic started, and that individuals outside of China do have access to these swabs. The swabs are positive for COVID-19, but we didn't yet have any indication that there was an animal of origin also implicated in the swabs. Now, after new analysis of these samples, they are saying this animal host could be the host. Whereas previously, the Chinese researchers, when they first uploaded the data and shared it, said, we've looked at it. No host can be deduced.
Right. So unless the FBI decides to declassify some information that really is like a smoking gun, this is, I think, the best.
They won't.
This is the best evidence that we have. This is, again, I don't think the lab leak theory is ever going to die, to be honest with you.
Nope. It'll be a fight for a long time.
Yeah. But ultimately, like, what is our level? Where do we say that the proof is proof enough? So, you know, the argument here is, yeah, if we could find a raccoon dog with COVID at that point in time and watch it biting a person, you know, like, oh, there, we saw the spillover event. But what they're saying is, in a single swab, if you've got genetic analysis or genetic material from a raccoon dog, you've got proof that a raccoon dog can carry this, and then you've got in that same swab COVID-19 mm-hmm. virus. That's yeah. kind of as close as we're probably going to get.
Yeah, it definitely strengthens that theory. Mm-hmm. One other quick follow-up before we get on to the news items. Remember I reported a few weeks ago on the meta-analysis looking at studies, asking the question of what physical measures work in reducing the spread of a respiratory virus, and they concluded that quote-unquote masks don't work. And oh, yeah. I pretty much tore apart.
Cochrane.
Yeah, that was a Cochrane review. I pretty much tore it apart. And specifically the way that the bottom line conclusion that was being presented by the lead author and by a lot of people who are, for whatever reason, want to believe that masks are not effective in preventing COVID. Since then, and I did get some pushback on email from some of our listeners on that, saying I was whatever, trying to dismiss the evidence. Although I did a very detailed analysis of why it was crap. And I wrote about it also on Science-Based Medicine, if you want to get into even more detail. Well, since then, there have been a number of other medical science communicators who have basically said the same thing that I did, although with sometimes different subsets of details that they focus on in terms of why the study did not show that masks do not work. And in fact, the best evidence shows that masks do work at reducing the risk of spreading and contracting COVID in high-risk situations if you wear the mask properly, like is the one big caveat. If you're not wearing it properly, it doesn't work. Since then, here's the new bit, right? The new bit is Cochrane now has walked back their conclusion because here's what they said. They felt compelled to put out a statement. They said, many commentators have claimed that a recently updated Cochrane review shows that, quote, masks don't work, which is an inaccurate and misleading interpretation. The review examined whether interventions to promote mask wearing help to slow the spread of respiratory viruses. Given the limitations in the primary evidence, the review is not able to address the question of whether mask wearing itself reduces people's risk of contracting or spreading respiratory viruses. This wording was open to misinterpretation, for which we apologize. So it's kind of a soft apology, but they're basically trying to walk back the way the study has been misrepresented. They specifically dinged the lead author. They said he specifically went out of his way during an interview to misrepresent the study. The study did not show mm-hmm. what he said, which again was the main point of the criticism.
Biased.
Yeah, it was clearly biased. So if you are interested in that, David Gorski did a follow-up post on Science-Based Medicine talking about Cochrane's walk back, also going into more detail on the things that I didn't write about when I discussed it, namely the history of Tom Jefferson, the lead author, who is sort of a chronic denialist when it comes to, like, he says, oh, vaccines don't work for this, they don't work for the flu, and things like that. So it's not surprising that he would come out with this and he would, you know, basically misrepresent the findings of the study in the media. So he does his usual deep dive going into that angle of things. So I would recommend you could read that for follow-up. All right, Jay, you're going to start us off with the news items with the new prototype lunar spacesuit.
Oh, boy.
Ooh. With tie and matching cummerbunds.
Yeah, this is a milestone because we really needed these spacesuits in order for the Artemis missions to continue. So how did NASA get it done? So it turns out that NASA and a company called Axiom Space, who is a NASA contractor, they revealed their new spacesuit on March 15th, 2023. So the version of the spacesuits they displayed, these are prototypes, but they're very close to the final product. And they're going to be used for training purposes later this year. So they're going to finalize these suits for the most part, you know, very soon. Now, these new spacesuits are intended for EVAs, right? These are for outside of the spacecraft, you know, anything outside of a spacecraft. That's what they're intended for. And the two main things are spacewalks, right? You have to repair the ship, go outside, do something, install something, or you're going to be walking on the moon's surface and eventually on, you know, maybe even Mars's surface.
Yeah, they hint that it's like multi-mission, you know, and they hint that eventually this, you know, could also be used on Mars.
Yeah, I'm sure they're going to iterate them. You know, it's not like you know, the old days where they make it and they don't really do anything. Like, you know, we have the technology to make materials and things much faster than we ever did. So they'll definitely be continuously improving these suits as they go. So aesthetically, they look really cool. If you haven't seen them, I recommend that you just take a quick look. You can Google it in a second and see it for yourself. But the version I saw, there was like a, you know, mostly black with orange detailing. There's a large dome for the wearer's head that gives them a really, really good field of view, much better than any other field of view I've seen. They have a great range of motion. They're easier to get into than previous suits. Like, for instance, these have a hinged back where you can open up the back of the suit. And then the astronaut will enter the suit feet first and kind of just slip into the suit that way instead of having it be done in pieces or like, you know, the upper part, you know, on the older suits, like you had to have the upper part like lowered onto you and stuff like that. It's very awkward. They're also much less bulky than the current EVA suits that are being used on the space station. And, you know, check this out. The current spacesuits that we are using today on the International Space Station are from the space shuttle. And they are 40-year-old technology.
Not
40
surprised.
Years old.
Wow.
Wow.
Like, let that sink in. That most people that will hear my voice were not born. You know what I mean?
Yeah, but Jay, there's space-age technology.
it's just interesting to think, you know, when NASA,
the 60s or 50s.
They made their last spacesuits, they worked really well. They were able to do what they needed them to do, and they just didn't have the time or money to... you know, to do what's happening today, which is, you know, redo the entire thing from, you know, from the ground up. Now, let me give you a little backstory here. So NASA was developing a space suit for the Artemis moon missions on their own. You might remember that NASA showed us a prototype of their space suit back in 2019. We talked about it on the show for sure. Now, that suit was called the XEMU, which stands for Exploration Extravehicular Mobility Unit. NASA was on track to spend a lot of money, you know, like in the billion plus US dollars to complete the spacesuit project. But the problem was, the main problem was that they were years away from being able to complete it. They weren't going to be able to have them ready for the Artemis 3 launch, which was absolutely necessary. You know, they had to be ready for Artemis 3 or Artemis 3 wasn't going to happen. So NASA realized that they needed to choose a contractor to finish a usable spacesuit. So, you know, they had mostly time constraints, but money was also, you know, a factor in these decisions as well. So Axiom was chosen in September of 2022. Now think about what I just said. Axiom was chosen in September of 2022, and they have their prototype done today, like, you know, as of a couple of days ago. So NASA...
And Jay, so NASA already dumped $420 million into their failed suit, which they're now, I guess, going to abandon. And
No, they didn't abandon it. They handed that suit over to Axiom, and Axiom took it from there. Like, so they
said,
okay,
Axiom or Axiom?
Whatever.
I think it's Axiom.
Yeah.
Depends on what part of the country you're in, I guess.
Yeah, Axiom sounds stupid.
All right, Axiom. All right, so what happened
was... They completed it for $228 million, but it looks completely different than the NASA suit.
Yeah, but there's a lot of technology in there that was ported over. I mean, they had a starting point.
Yeah.
So NASA got into a $3.5 billion contract with them. And now this contract is pretty interesting. So it means that NASA will not own any of the new spacesuits, that they will engage in essentially a service contract with that company, and the company will be responsible to provide NASA the suits that they need whenever they need them, and, you know, I guess, and however many that they need. It's not a contract that's going to last forever, of course. There is some time limit to it. I couldn't find any more details about the contract, but what I do
know
is...
You know what it's called? I found some details. You know what it's called, first of all?
Yeah, go ahead, say it.
Well, Axiom is going to be providing, quote, moonwalking services. That's what they're calling it, moonwalking services. I also found out that NASA, even though, you know, they're just contracting out these services, in the contract, NASA gets, whether licensure or ownership or whatever, to all of the knowledge that develops from using these suits on their missions. So they own the tech, basically.
Axiom could also sell their suit technology to anybody that they want as well, which is a two-way street. Yeah.
And also, they contracted with Collins Aerospace, so it's a competition between two companies. And that's, again, also going to play in NASA's favor.
But this is all part of, you know, the budding industry, which is going to be space travel. And NASA is encouraging companies to invest time and money into developing technology for this because, you know, all ships rise in a rising tide. You know, they want more space exploration. They want more, you know, technology that goes into this so everything gets better. So I totally see what they're doing here, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, they're going to be outsourcing a lot of future work to companies that normally they would do in-house. They're not going to do it that way anymore. So
I think
Axiom,
that's a good thing.
Axiom ended up taking the XEMU suit, like I said, and they started developing their version of it from that starting point, and they used NASA's suit design and technology, but they made a lot of improvements, and they did complete the build, which is pretty shocking thinking that they've only been doing it since September of last year. They were able to do this for less money than it would have cost NASA, and they were definitely able to do it in a time frame that makes all these things line up correctly. Now, the final design of their suit has increased flexibility, better technology to protect the astronauts from outer space and the lunar surface. This includes dramatic changes in temperature that astronauts have to go through. Like, let's say you're on the surface of the moon and you walk from a lit area of the moon to shadow. You know, we're talking about hundreds of degrees temperature change, just like that, you know, from moment to moment. So it was really important that the boots are insulated to handle really frigid temperatures on the moon's south pole, which, you know, spacesuits have not been, you know, used that way before. So they were aware that the boots were going to be coming in contact with incredibly cold temperatures on the moon's south pole. So they, you know, built that technology in there to handle that.
I like the fact that they have a HD camera built into the helmet.
Hell yeah. Why wouldn't they?
Right?
What kind of HD?
I don't know. Just
8K camera. Probably.
So yeah,
I doubt that.
That's true. They also, you know, no, they also though. Have
4K,
you know, lights nice. Mounted to the helmet. I mean, very much like this is getting very close to all the science fiction spacesuits that we've seen. You know, it's the Martian
kind of a feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, they have improved flexibility. Like they're able to walk, bend, twist, squat, crouch. Like none of these body movements were really you were not able to do that in previous spacesuits. You know, they're very much built for low gravity moon missions. And just so you know, Axiom's new suit is called the AXEMU, right? So they kind of combined the NASA name with their name. Another substantial upgrade that Axiom made was to make the suits modular so they can fit 90% of males and female body types, which if you've read into anything about spacesuits, you know, historically, they have a big problem with today's spacesuits because when they want to fit one to a person that might have a smaller body type, they've been having a lot of trouble doing it. There's only so many larges and mediums that they have. But these spacesuits are completely swappable. There's lots of components. Like you could change the length of the legs and the arms very quickly with the main body of the suit. So they could fit basically anybody. And they also have the ability to alter the suits so they fit each individual even better. So inside the suits, there's things that they can do to make them really, you know, fit like a glove and personalize the way that the suits fit. Just one more thing that I found out, that when you do look at the pictures of these spacesuits and you're going to see that they're black and orange, they're actually going to be white when they're put out on the mission because that's to reflect solar radiation because you don't want the suits to heat up. So they have to, you know, they're actually trying to keep the suits as cool as possible.
Yeah, but just the training suits will be black. This is like one of the last pieces of the puzzle that NASA needed to get to the moon, right? Because they mean that. As SLS is working, that's probably going to all be work out. If they needed the spacesuits and the lunar lander. And so now they got the spacesuit. So now they just need like an actual functioning lunar lander.
Right. That's coming.
And it,
coming soon. Yeah.
Hopefully. All right. Thanks, Jay. All right, Kara, tell us about end-of-life care. How are we taking care of people who are dying?
Right. So anytime there is a news article that sort of, I guess, coalesces with my fundamental interests in research and clinical practice, I'm always excited. So I'm glad when I put this in the list, you were like, yeah, you can do that. Like, thanks, Steve. Because this one I think was especially interesting to me. It's actually about aggressive end-of-life care. And of course, that's kind of a construct. How do we define what aggressive end of life care is, and I'll kind of get into how the authors did it. And so it's a collaborative group of individuals who published in JAMA Network Open. And the title of this study is Incidence of Aggressive End of Life Care Among Older Adults with Metastatic Cancer Living in Nursing Homes and Community Settings. So basically, they posed an interesting question, which was, do older adults with metastatic cancer get more aggressive end-of-life care if they're living in a nursing home versus living in the community? Ultimately, the answer to that question is probably not the most interesting finding in this study. There's a lot of interesting findings, but how they decided to go about answering that question is they looked at basically a large data set. It's a cohort study that used a data set called the Surveillance Epidemiology and End Results Database, which is linked with the Medicare database and the minimum data set. And they were able to basically pull out 146,329 older adult patients. I think the average age was around 78. So even older than that. Okay, the average age was around 78. It was just over half men, 52% men. So it's a pretty robust sample of individuals covering deaths that occurred between January 1st, 2013 to December 31st, 2017. All of these patients, the full 146 plus thousand patients, had metastatic breast, colorectal, lung, pancreatic, or prostate cancer. And so they were like, okay, we're going to look at all of this data and we're going to say, what is the incidence rate of those who were living in nursing facilities versus those who were living in the community? What is the incidence rate of what we would consider to be aggressive end-of-life care? And they operationally defined that a handful of ways. They said, they're continuing to get their cancer treated. They are admitted to the intensive care unit. They had more than one emergency department visit or more than one hospitalization within the last 30 days of life. They died in the hospital, or they were enrolled in hospice, but only within 3 days of death, right? So clearly not early enough to kind of get the care that's necessary from hospice. So they saw all of those different parameters as being sort of indices or, you know, different constructs that they thought were an appropriate way to sort of signal aggressive end-of-life care. So I guess before I go on, I'm curious, do you guys agree with those different markers? Do you think that that's appropriate?
I mean, they're not unreasonable, right? But they're just markers. You know, they're
just markers, and they make that point a lot because it's really hard to know when you're looking at a huge cohort study like this whether some of these people wanted aggressive end of life care or not.
Right.
You know, some people, it is their culture, it is their ideology, and it is their deepest wish to have every option made available to them, regardless of their age, regardless of their outcome risk. You know, for some people, that's not the case. Actually, for most people, that's not the case. But there are some people who will always want the whole book thrown at them. And so it is important to remember that they couldn't tease those people out of this study. And that probably did bias the results a little bit. And also sometimes, you know, things happen and people may not have been declining as quickly and then they might have died suddenly. That said, part of the smart thing that they did is they looked specifically at people with metastatic cancer. So they weren't just looking at older adults who were like generally healthy. They were looking at people who specifically probably had poorer prognoses. And they wanted to know, you know, community dwelling versus nursing homes, what are we looking at here? And they found some pretty interesting findings. There wasn't a huge difference, although there was a significant difference, it just wasn't huge, between nursing home residents and community dwelling residents. Who do you think was receiving more aggressive end-of-life care?
I'm going to say nursing home.
Yep, nursing home residents. But here's the thing that I find more interesting, 64% versus 58%. So basically, still most people are getting aggressive end-of-life care in the last month of their life. We're talking about within 30 days. That's where those markers were measured. Something is wrong here when we know that over and over and over the literature show, and there's so much literature to back this up, that most people want to die at home. Most people who have end-stage, at least metastatic cancer, have things like a DNAR in place. I shouldn't say most people, but many people have things like a DNAR in place, a pulsed in place, different sort of measures to try and prevent aggressive end-of-life care. And yet we still see that the general bias is toward fighting really, really hard and utilizing very often expensive, unwanted, poorer outcome, aggressive treatments when somebody is very often going to die anyway. And here comes this really complicated question about end-of-life care and how we can do things differently, because advocates have been working on this for a really long time. What do you think is kind of the number one thing? And, you know, this study points to it, but it's not what this study is about. What do you think is the number one thing that most experts within the medical professions point to that they say is protective against this?
Protective against doing too much at the end of life?
Yep.
Is advanced directives.
Advanced directives are really helpful, but I would say it's probably not the number one thing. It's super important, though. But the number one thing is early palliative intervention.
Mm-hmm.
It's like when somebody is diagnosed with a life-limiting illness, start palliative treatment early. And there's so much stigma against palliative care in this country because I think people equate the word palliative with death. But that's not what palliation is. Palliation, by definition, is easing symptoms. That's all it is. A palliative care physician is an expert in symptom management. Many people who get palliative care live long, full lives.
Yeah, I think they confuse palliative care with only palliative care, which is not necessarily the same thing.
Which is a component of hospice treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why things get a little bit confusing. There's another problem that they talk about in this New York Times article, which I find really fascinating, which is the question of palliative interventions that could be seen as life-extending interventions, but they're used in a palliative way, and the complicated rules around hospice. So I'm going to do a quick and dirty on hospice. I'm not a hospice expert, but I've attended a lot of, you know, trainings in this area, and I've worked kind of near and around hospice quite a lot. Hospice in this country, I'm very specifically saying in America because there are hospice benefits in other countries, is a Medicare benefit that is basically free for anybody on Medicare to get 6 months of supportive treatment as they're nearing end of life. They have to have 6 months or less of a prognosis, and then they have a lot of really incredible benefits that are available to them. But basically the trade-off there is that they can no longer receive life-extending treatment, if that makes sense. So somebody's dying of cancer, they decide, I no longer want to get my chemotherapy, I'm ready to enter into hospice. Then they move over into a treatment paradigm which is about comfort. The issue is some people might get palliative cancer treatment. I had a very patient who had a tumor wrapping around her trachea. She was getting palliative radiation. There was no intention that this was going to cure her, but it was making it hard to breathe. And so the radiation was making it so that in her last, you know, days, weeks, months, she was more comfortable. And in the article, they talk quite a bit about palliative dialysis, which is a different model than dialysis for like curative purposes. Yet there's still some confusion about what treatments can people have when they're in hospice care. And that may be one reason, in addition to cultural reasons, in addition to stigma reasons, and in addition to just low information, why people often choose not to go into hospice. They see it as a harbinger of death. They fear what hospice means when ultimately anybody who works in hospice sees that actually the outcomes are much better. People tend to live longer. People tend to have better outcomes when they have less aggressive medical intervention and more palliatively focused intervention, which is sort of ironic. It's like paradoxical, but when you really start to think about it, it makes sense. And it's unfortunate because this is, I think, just such a taboo subject still in our society and our culture. We don't talk about it enough. And because we don't talk about it, there's a lot of misunderstandings. There's a lot of stigma. And what ultimately ends up happening, as we see time and time again, is that people wait way too long to do any decision making around it. And then they make decisions under duress. And that's, you know, obviously going to be the least conducive way to have the best potential outcomes. And outcomes are variable. For some people, an outcome is a longer life, sure. But for many people, a positive outcome is better quality of life. But ultimately, the interesting takeaway of this study is that aggressive medical care is really, really common in this country at the end of life. And there are very few situations in which aggressive medical care makes sense at the end of life. Invasive, intensive surgeries, where it's very unlikely that somebody would be able to recover from that, are very often done probably more for psychological purposes than for actual medical purposes. And that ultimately becomes a massive waste of money, and it becomes a very sadly clear way for somebody to suffer needlessly in their final days, weeks, months.
Is there an industry that's pushing it?
Well, I mean, there is a question around whether medical care, I mean, what industry, like quote unquote the medical industry, but like what really does that look like, right?
Well, but, I think right, some I mean, of it's. I know a lot of people spend a lot of their dollars at the end of their life for this kind of thing. So, you know, I hate to be so cynical, but there's money to be made here. And therefore, you know, you got to figure some people have an interest sort of in pushing this kind of. These kinds of choices.
But ultimately, the people who make those decisions, if you think about it, are the families and their physicians. It's not the insurance companies or the company, like the, you know, the medical supply manufacturers. You know, the people who stand to make money from the utilization of these things are not the same people that are making the decisions about whether or not these things are appropriate. They are the actual boots on the ground physicians and the families. And I think that, yes, that may be a small variable. I don't think we can say 100% that never happens, because there's a million variables that we have to tease out. But I think more often, the reason that aggressive medical care happens is because there is a culture of, well, we have to do everything we can. Otherwise, we didn't love you enough. Otherwise, we didn't try hard enough. Otherwise, we didn't do our jobs well enough. And there's this really intense sense of failure and shame around not doing, quote, everything, when mm-hmm. ultimately doing everything is actually more harmful than doing less. Mm-hmm. And that's the culture shift that I think we're starting to move toward, the paradigm. But what's required to make that paradigm shift is experts in this field. It's palliative care physicians, it's hospice experts, it's nurses who have expertise in this area. We can't expect that all physicians are trained in this paradigm, because they're just not.
Evan, to address your question a little bit too, so it's a bit of a myth that like there's a disproportionate amount of healthcare expenses that are at the end of life. About 11% of healthcare costs are in the last year of life, which doesn't seem, you know, out of proportion to me, given that, of course it is, that's when you're going to be sickest, right? You know, when you're dying. And you also have to remember that we don't always know when you're in the last year of your life. You know, a lot of the times we're trying to extend your life and we fail, and, you know, you die regardless of aggressive treatment. And so that ends up being a lot of aggressive treatment towards the end of your life. Doesn't mean it was worthless or had no chance of working. Kara's talking about when we know we're in the last year of life, because you have a terminal
diagnosis. Right, specifically
diagnosis.
This study.
Yeah, this study. That's a little bit of a different situation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I agree with what you're saying. My personal experience, and this is obviously biased by my neurological background, is that overly aggressive care, in my experience, is almost always driven by the family. You know, physicians are usually relieved when we can back off on a case that we know has a really bad prognosis. Again, it's biased, because in my line of work, a bad prognosis means like your brain is damaged. You know, it's not. It's
right.
Different.
So you have, sort of have had to go through that kind of deep training.
It's also about quality of life. You know, it's their, what's their functionality going to be? If they do manage to somehow survive, they're not going to be neurologically intact. As opposed to somebody that's a bad heart and an intact brain, if they could survive, you know, that whatever condition their heart has, they can have. Mentally a full quality of life. Neurologically, if you're struggling to survive, you're probably not going to get back to your neurological baseline. But in any case, it's very complicated, because you don't want to fall for ages and we're like, oh, you're too old to treat, you know, to put a lot of resources into. And, you know, I think people, you do have a right to aggressive care when it's appropriate. And it's what they want. So I think the things we absolutely have to correct are people getting aggressive care they don't want. That's a lose-lose. We have to make sure that doesn't happen.
And I think some of it is just the culture of America. You know, it is our fundamental culture.
A lot of it is culture. A lot of it is trust, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. But also, there isn't a mechanism to efficiently resolve any conflict. And the default is to do everything, and that may not be
the default.
It should not be full code.
I agree.
I think that if, you know, there should be a very efficient mechanism by which if you have, you know, whatever, two physicians say this is futile care, that becomes the default. Mm-hmm. The problem, but the unfortunately, the problem is, like, if they say, oh, this is futile care, basically we're going to pull the plug, whatever that means technically in that particular case. You can't take back that decision, right? So, like, right. You have to go through the whole process of resolving any conflicts surrounding withdrawal of care before you do it. And I've seen that take a really long time. So I was like, oh, okay, 1 month and $1 million later, we're doing the inevitable. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, that was completely...
And that person was potentially suffering. Their families were suffering that entire time. And honestly, the medical providers are suffering and dealing with vicarious trauma that whole time.
It's very stressful to watch that situation, to have to take care of a patient that you know it's futile and it's not pleasant, you know?
And really, this shouldn't be on the shoulders only of the physicians. This should be a cultural shift and a cultural conversation that we're having. And we should all be starting to accept more responsibility around what happens at the end of life. But unfortunately, in America, we are very death-denying, and this stuff, we tend to sweep it into the shadows.
Yeah.
We don't bring it out in the open.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Bob, I understand that GPT-4 dropped.
Oh no! I mean, yay!
Yeah, right. This is earlier than I anticipated. So yeah, it happened. Generative, pre-trained, Transformer version 4, or more simply, GPT-4 has been released. OpenAI's latest version of the software that underpins the now infamous ChatGPT text generating tool is out. So what's the bottom line? Yeah, I know we talked about ChatGPT recently, but this latest update to a full version, full 4.0 from 3.5 has been greatly anticipated. There's been rumors and discussions for months about what it would be like and when it would be released. So I think it definitely deserves a discussion. So if you haven't been paying attention to GPT, well, you know, now's a good time, I think. Trust me, this is only going to get bigger. Mm-hmm. And if you read a lot of, you know, science news, tech news, AI news especially, oh, it's all over the place, man. GPT again stands for OpenAI's Generative Pre-trained Transformers, which are deep learning AI models that process language. Large language models, LLMs, you'll probably see that initialism a lot. So they're trained on huge data sets of human-generated text. They have many applications, including language modeling. There's also translation, of course, and obviously generating very human-like text for applications like chatbots. The previous version 3.5, which was used for ChatGPT, pretty much caused an unprecedented AI uproar, right? Was that a good way to classify that?
I thought it was more of a kerfuffle.
Oh, no, much more than a kerfuffle. Oh, my goodness. Much closer to uproar.
The Donnybrook?
The art generators, like Midjourney, that was more of a kerfuffle. This is more of an uproar. Now, students are using it to write their papers, right? And countless articles and Reddit comments, oh my God, are out there claiming that all our jobs are in jeopardy. And some even audaciously claim that full-blown AIs and the singularity, if they haven't finally arrived, are probably only months away. Oh my God. That last bit is not true, but lots of people are saying it and believing it. So now ChatGPT 4 has been released, and I think we're not prepared for what will ensue. It's going to be a hell of a ride. So, all right. So what do we know about this release? OpenAI said the following about it in their blog Tuesday, March 14th, the day before the Ides of March, Steve. They said GPT-4 is a large multimodal model accepting image and text inputs, emitting text outputs, that, while less capable than humans in many real-world scenarios, exhibits human-level performance on various professional and academic benchmarks. Over the past 2 years, we rebuilt our entire deep learning stack and co-designed a supercomputer from the ground up for our workload. I recommend their full OpenAI's full blog on that. A lot of more details in their blog. So let's get to the meat then. The question of the day, I think, is what's the difference between 4 and 3.5, right? OpenAI says, in casual conversation, the distinction can be subtle. The difference comes out when the complexity of the task reaches a sufficient threshold. GPT-4 is more reliable, creative, and able to handle much more nuanced instructions than GPT-3.5. Okay, so now to determine quantitatively what this difference is, They tested 4 and 3.5 on different benchmarks, like I said. One representative example was a simulated bar exam. 3.5 was in the bottom 10% when they tested it. 4.0 was in the top 10% of test takers. So dramatic, 90th percentile. It exceeds the average score for real humans taking the bar. That's impressive. And a lot of the test results that I saw were similar, where 4.0 was much more impressive than 3.5. And just many of them were just generally impressive overall. Let's see, GPT-3 had a limit of 1,500 words in terms of like what you could ask and what it would come back with. 4.0's limit is 25,000 words of text, something like 50 pages. So you can just throw a huge science article at it and just say, and ask it questions about it. And that's what I will certainly be using it for, just as a preliminary, like get an assessment for the research, especially if it's very technical. So the most dramatic changes, though, seems to be this multimodal aspect to it, meaning that you could feed it not only text but images, which it can analyze based on your questions about it. So if you give it an image, it will accurately describe not only what's in the image, but it'll describe the scene as well, apparently. So, for example, Jay is in the picture with meatballs. He's making dinner. I'm assuming it could come out with something similar to that.
That picture is on my wall right now.
Nice. Now, when I heard that, where it could actually generate descriptions of what's in the scene, the first thing I thought of was the 30,000 iPhone pictures I have that are always a pain in the ass to search, because of course I haven't sorted them properly, because now it's just way too daunting of a task to even contemplate. But I love the idea of like, yeah, go through all my pictures. And then if I do a search on show me all my zombie figures, it would just bam, all just come
29,000.
I'm looking forward to that. Okay, so the image analysis goes even another level deeper. There was a demo where they showed ChatGPT-4. They showed it an image of a boxing glove hanging over a seesaw, right? With an object on the other end of the seesaw that was lowered to the ground. And it asked, what would happen if the glove dropped? And it correctly predicted that the object would be launched upwards. So it kind of like understands like the physics, he knows what the thing was, you know, kind of, you know, can explain what the object is and anticipate what would happen given a specific scenario. So, all right, how about this one? You can show it a picture of a website, maybe one that you drew on a napkin, and it could output the code for a functional version of that website.
Wow.
So that's pretty cool. That's fairly impressive. Wow. I like that idea. At the very least, you can get a start on a website. I'm not sure, you know, what the prompt would have to be. You know, you'd have to add many more prompts, obviously, to really get something complicated, I would think. Oh, how about this one? This was even more impressive in a lot of ways. They showed it a joke in the form of a series of images, and it showed a cell phone with the wrong charger, and it correctly explained why it was funny. And, you know, being able to deconstruct a joke and correctly express why a person would find it funny, that's pretty impressive. I kind of liked that ability. I didn't think it would be able to do that, even necessarily with version 4.0, but that's pretty slick. Okay, so some of the obvious quick take downsides is that the image analysis piece is not available to the general public. And the explanation that they give is that they need to more fully assess the potential abuses, like using it for mass surveillance. I mean, if it could recognize, right, people and things and objects in a scene, it that would be a hell of a tool for nefarious purposes. Although we have similar tools already. I mean, you know, you walk into any good casino, probably in almost in the world, and they know that who you are before you even walk in the place, generally speaking. But I'm sure this has even, you know, more capability and utility. The other thing is that OpenAI, for now at least, is very secretive. If more of a closed AI, they're not disclosing details about the training data or other information, and that's, you know, that's not good. I mean, it's good for them because they can then build on it, and they're not communicating it to the community, though. So the community in general would suffer from this lack of transparency. So I'm not sure, you know, what the plan is for that. I mean, maybe that's just the no-brainer business decision that they have to make at this point. and to not share all the details that could then be copied. I don't know. So a lot of that is very impressive, and I think we will be discovering even more capabilities that even OpenAI is not aware of. There are scientists that are using it that were generally impressed, but then they would feed it a lot of technical articles, and then they became much more impressed with its ability, and also discovering new abilities that they didn't even anticipate. So that's interesting. There's also this idea of, you know, emergent properties as things become more complex. That's something that was discovered even in 3.5. So who knows what kind of emergent properties might come out of 4.0, something that they really aren't even aware of right now. So, but the big but here is that the downsides that have been clearly identified in 3.5, the fears and the abuses of the system, GPT 3.5, it was prone to make stuff up, right? I mean, something that's being called hallucinations. So there's a lot of hallucinating going on, coming out with these apparent facts with extreme confidence that are just flat out wrong. And then also, ChatGPT could get like weird and even scary. There's examples of kind of like scary quotes that are like, whoa, what's going on there? There's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of potential issues that have been raised. So what is OpenAI doing about that? And I got to say that I'm kind of happy with, at least initially in my research, with the approach that they're taking on dealing with that stuff. These OpenAI scientists classify much of this bad behavior as an alignment issue. And if you're familiar with the, you know, artificial general intelligence discussion groups, there's a lot of talk about the alignment problem. And alignment in the sense that AI is not aligned with our human values, for example, right? So OpenAI is saying things that sound good from what I could tell so far. They seem to be taking these issues very seriously. For example, they say, we've trained language models that are much better at following user intentions than GPT-3, while also making them more truthful and less toxic using techniques developed through our alignment research. The result they claim is that GPT-4 is our best ever results, though far from perfect, on factuality, steerability, and refusing to go outside of the guardrails. So it's better than GPT-3 or 3.5 in those areas. I think it's going to be very hard, though, I don't think we could really reasonably expect them to do away with all of it. There's always going to be probably some sort of fact problems and kind of like going over the guardrails from time to time. I think they can lessen the incidences happening, but I don't think they're going to really get rid of – you're not going to get rid of it 100%, I think, because then at that point, if they did, you'd be changing the fundamental aspects of GPT too much. So I think it's going to be there to some degree, even with GPT 5 and 6 or whatever. The Bing version 4.0 has been available for the past month, kind of like secretly, what? You know, swapped out 3.5 with 4 for the past month, which was interesting. So you can use it now. There's a waiting list and also a waiting list to use it for APIs, but people are using it now. And like I said, the image analysis aspect is going to be delayed while they look at it. And so a lot of this is interesting and fascinating and has amazing potential. But as I said, the downside, the potential of this amazing tool to weaponize disinformation and misinformation, it just gets scarier and scarier the more I think about it. You know, this tool has passed the conversational uncanny valley. Mm-hmm. That hill is done. And, with humans and their overactive agency detection, it's just way too easy to fool people into thinking, you know, to be fooled by these tools.
So it's passed the Turing test.
Turing test is so antiquated at this point. It's not what we thought it was, even just a few years ago. It's too easy to be fooled. And that makes it very dangerous. And I think we really need to put in some very thoughtful safeguards. I read some of the comments made by philosopher and cognitive scientist Daniel Dennett, Steve, making mm-hmm. interesting points. He's made some interesting points. Let me do some of his quotes here. I found these very interesting. He said regarding the technology's creators, they should be held accountable. They're on the verge, if they haven't already done it, of creating very serious weapons of destruction against the stability and security of society. They should take that as seriously as the molecular biologists have taken the prospect of biological warfare. that was really interesting. And I think there's a lot to that statement that I think a lot of people need to be thinking seriously about. He says that this is the real code red. We need to institute new attitudes, new laws, and spread them rapidly and remove the valorization of fooling people, the anthropomorphization. We want smart machines, not artificial colleagues. I really like that statement. He's right. We want the smart machines and the artificial colleagues, at least the way the technology is now and the way it's going to be in the near future, artificial colleagues can be very dangerous, very, very dangerous. And so, as much as I hate to potentially slow down some of the advances in artificial intelligence and all the benefits it can bring to society, this is one of those disruptive technologies that I've talked about for a long time. Although this specific application involving large language models was less obvious, I think, and predictable than the easier low-hanging fruit like, say, nanotech gray goo. Yeah, of course, that's something that's easier to spot. Not too many people really saw this specific scenario coming. So we lost out on potentially having more years of discussing it and preparing for it. But it's here and it's now. And we gotta reap its benefits, but we also have to be very, very careful because this can be, very dangerous. And so Daniel Dennett has some interesting things to say about it.
I mean, I think that this is going to be a story we're going to be talking about all year and into the next few years as new iterations keep going. We're still on the steep part of the curve here, where, new iterations are going to come out. And by the time we sort of settle into what one version could do, the next one's going to be here, Feels like that's just what happened with GPT-4.
Oh boy, it's
and I'm sure there's going to be revelations even over the next few weeks. There could be many revelations, and we may even need another update on 4 and what 4 is about and what's been discovered that isn't really in the news even now.
All right, you guys know what Terminator habitability is?
No,
habitable.
What? Habitable.
Terminator habitability.
Like,
all right,
like the Terminator,
the way robots, where they live, like, and what kind of environments they like, that kind of stuff.
This is the idea. We've talked about this before. The idea that there could be a habitable belt around gravitationally locked planets, orbiting
tidally
and
locked.
Dwarf stars. Yeah, they're tidally locked, so that one side of the planet always faces their parent star. The other side always faces away.
So one's super hot, one's super cold, and in between it can be
in between, which is
habitable.
The Terminator, right?
The Goldilocks.
That's the Terminator
part
is
the
in between. So that could be habitable. So the news is that astronomers have for the first time used climate modeling software to model what the climate on such a planet might be.
What took them so long to do that?
I don't know. But here, previous research focused on eye region habitability. Have you ever heard
eye
of that,
region?
Bob? Yeah.
E-Y-E.
So
spell it. What kind of eye?
EYE.
Are you talking about?
In other words, just
the storm
the part, just the part of the planet facing the star is habitable, because it's at that towards the outer part of the habitable zone, so that part of the planet that's always getting light.
It's just warm enough. It's just
warm enough to keep water in liquid state, and then the rest of the planet is frozen. This pushes it in between a hot and a cold zone. Again, sort of this equatorial Terminator zone.
Planets can lock to the star at that distance, though? I thought they always had to be close to the star.
It's still close.
Close.
Because M dwarfs are red dwarfs. They don't give off a lot of energy, a lot of heat, and so you have to be relatively close. In order to be close enough that water could be liquid, you probably will be tidally locked. All right, so this is what they found. Now, here's another reason why previous studies suggested that this may not be possible, because they were focusing on water-rich planets, right? Like, if you look at the Earth, which is a water-rich planet, 75% of the surface covered by water. If we were tidally locked around an M dwarf, then the ocean on the side of the planet facing the sun, facing the dwarf star, would evaporate.
Boil.
And would cover the planet in a thick cloud of water vapor, which is not good.
But wouldn't it freeze and drop on the other side, on the far side?
Yeah, but what would happen, though? I mean, I think it would be a constant cycle of that happening. And so there would be this shroud of water vapor that's what the model showed, right? It'd be a cloud of water vapor that would not be good for habitability. But they said, all right, but what if, this is the new bit, what if we model a planet that's tidally locked around an M dwarf that's not water rich, right? That's a little bit drier. And so that the side of, so what you say happens, Bob, there's very little water on the side of the planet facing the star, and that water evaporates and eventually whatever, it's a desert. So you have a desert on the side of the planet facing the star. You have glaciers on the other side, and you have the terminator zone of habitability. Could that work? What would that be like? And the modeling that they published said, yes, that could work. You could have a terminator habitability on those planets. Yeah,
that's
so
awesome.
It depends on a couple of variables. You know, they had to, they took model climate models used for Earth. They had to be able to say, okay, but we have to change the rotation rate, right, to match a tidally locked planet. But otherwise, they used, you know, the models that we use for Earth's climate. And they found that, you know, there would be limited energy transfer, right? If you don't have an ocean on the front side of the planet, that really limits the heat transfer so that you do end up with that terminator zone with, you know, hot and cold separated. Because other previous models also suggested that with a lot of water, there would also be a lot of heat transfer, and which would cool the hot side and warm the cold side. And so there would be actually a broad zone of habitability, but then that was complicated by the problem of too much water vapor in that model. So maybe this might be the model that works, right? The terminator habitability. Now, the reason for the interest in this is because M dwarfs are the most common stars in the galaxy, right? In the universe, there's what, like 75-80% of the stars out there are M dwarfs.
Yeah, man, it's
are
a lot.
These red dwarfs. And so if they could potentially have planets with habitable zones with life on them, that dramatically
life everywhere.
Increases yeah the amount of life that there would be on average, the density of life sustaining planets. There are still some problems though, right? The big problem is that, you know, the red dwarfs are unstable. And early on in their life, they're massively unstable. They would definitely rip away the atmosphere of any planets that were in the habitable zone. They do settle down relatively, but they're even in their mature settled down state, they're still more active than, say, a yellow sun.
And if you're close to that, it might be pretty bad.
Yeah, so it's still an unresolved, I think, debate if there is a sweet spot where you could have a planet that either migrates in later in the age of the
star, yeah,
or reconstitutes an atmosphere somehow through outgassing or whatever. And would the star be settled down enough that a planet could hold on to the atmosphere? Maybe once it's tidally locked, you know, where most of the atmosphere is away from the star, right? It's on the other side of the planet. Would that be enough to hold on to enough of an atmosphere? I don't know. I think that's still an open question, but clearly astronomers have not given up on this idea. And this is, you know, the latest research in that. And still, you know, I think we're left with the conclusion that the most likely candidate for life are orange stars, because that's the sweet spot. It's probably orange stars. Because again, the cooler the star, the longer they last, but the cooler they are. Red dwarfs are too unstable. You know, yellow stars like our own are sort of obviously can have life on it, but they live for 6 to 8 billion years, you know, something like that. Orange stars live for tens of billions of years, 20, 30, 40 billion.
Nice.
And they're stable, and they have a nice habitable zone where you don't have to be tidally locked. So they might be in the sweet spot for life. Number of stars out there, right? So most stars with life may be orange stars.
Yeah, giant stars, no. They go through, right. Even though they have much, much more fuel, they go through it.
Blue stars, no.
Hundreds of millions of years. Yeah. They live like hundreds of millions of years. Not very long for
really big
life
ones,
to evolve. Yeah,
right.
The biggest ones.
So what makes a star have a different color light?
It's just their mass. That's it.
Oh, it's all about
the
size.
The bigger they are, yeah. the hotter they burn, and the temperature is color, right? So they go from red to orange to yellow to blue, and there's no green
what
stars.
What about the white
though.
Ones?
Yeah,
are white ones weird? Sorry, aren't there white dwarfs?
Yeah, white dwarves, but they're not big.
Oh, you're right. They're not really stars.
They're not burning hydrogen. Like they're not white because they're hot. It just so some of like there's no green stars,
because
of the physics of how it works. You know, it's I remember Phil Plait had a good explanation for why they're on one of
them. And white dwarves are like remnants, right?
They're remnants.
The core. Yeah.
I think you go from yellow to blue. Basically, is what happens as you get hotter. Just as a feature of the temperature. You can get bright yellow, almost white, from what I understand, like red, but then it converts into blue as they get hotter.
Yeah, I'm seeing here skips that stars, over green. Stars harder than the sun also look white. It isn't until you reach a temperature around 11,000 Kelvin before it starts to look blue from our perspective.
Yeah. All right. Evan, give us a quick update on the Ohio chemical spill hubbub. Now, this is a hubbub.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, and we've had some requests to, give maybe a little update on this. It happened a little while ago, but I'll get you up to speed. Here's the background. February 3rd, a train derailed in Ohio in a town called East Palestine. There were a total of 50 cars on this train, 38 of them derailed. All of them were eventually damaged by a fire and subsequent controlled burn that followed. There were chemicals being transported and nearly a million pounds of vinyl chloride, along with 9 other substances that are deemed hazardous to people, animals, and the environment. The company that runs the rail, or at least this particular train, Norfolk Southern Corporation, their officials say that some of the cars carrying the vinyl chloride were not breached during the crash, but they were at risk for exploding. So a few days later, February 6th, the crews released and burned those contents and created a massive smoke plume above the town for several hours. This is all within a few days of obviously everything having happened. It made enormous news. That's the very basic background information. Some of the recent developments have been concerning the health and well-being of the residents inside and on the outskirts of East Palestine. So this particular update comes from a joint report from the Ohio Department of Health and the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Some residents participated in a health assessment survey, and they released the result of those surveys or the survey. It showed that the most common symptoms being experienced by residents include headaches, coughing, and anxiety. So 168 surveys were completed. And of those, 125 people reported headaches, 108 reported anxiety, 103 of them reported coughing. Others were fatigue and tiredness, 97 of the 168 participants, and irritation, burning of the skin, 88 of them. Almost, that's about half. As part of the same report, they say that the water sample results from private water systems of East Palestine homes continued to show no harmful levels of contaminants. There were 157 private systems tested. None have shown harmful levels of the contaminants, so that's a good sign. The derailment and subsequent controlled burn required that evacuation orders had to go out for people in a 2-mile radius, but they were allowed back shortly after the February 6th controlled burn. But anyone not heeding the orders at the time were told to remain indoors. A few days later, by February 8th, people said that it was safe to return to their homes. This recent report basically reemphasize that it for anybody who, for whatever reason, has not gone back at this point, it is safe to go back to your homes. They're still testing the water. They're still testing the air, and they've not detected any concerning levels of contaminants. This particular report also addressed the issue of animal necropsies, which is an autopsy of animals that had died at the time of the derailment. They said the preliminary reports on 6 deceased wildlife animals submitted to the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and Ohio's Department of Agricultural Animal Disease Diagnostic Laboratory, they showed no evidence to support chemical toxicity as a cause of death. Because one of the first things, obviously, when this was all new and occurring, is that there were wide reports of wildlife having died within, you know, hours, you know, first 24, 48 hours of the spill having occurred. But again, preliminary and kind of everybody's, you know, upset about everything, and you're fast to blame the spill on it, but they've not been able to find the evidence to support that the toxicity is the cause of the death of these animals.
Who is they in all of these equations? Who's actually doing all of these studies?
So these are, again, the report came from the Ohio Department of Health and U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Okay.
So their affiliates or whomever the departments that report to them or work in concert with them are the ones. So state level agencies and federal level agencies. But there's more. There was another report, an independent assessment that came out. This one came from researchers from Texas A&M University and Carnegie Mellon University. So what they found is they did air samples of East Palestine, and they said that there are detectable levels, higher than normal levels of certain chemicals in the air. Acrolein, benzene, vinyl chloride, butadiene, naphthalene, trichloroethylene, and trichloroethane. That's a lot. So these are, among the chemicals that the train was obviously carrying, and there are some detectable levels in the air. However, the results also showed normal levels of what are called the BTEX, BTEX chemicals, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzenes and xylenes. Those are associated with petrol products. Those are known to have carcinogenic effects, but they said those levels were nominal. So that's some more good news. But they said the acrolein is perhaps the one that had the highest concentration. And what they basically said is that it's as if you were in a major city. That's the kind of level of acrolein that you're experiencing in these air samples in East Palestine. So it's unusual for East Palestine, and it's up, you know, by quite a bit of numbers. But, you know, I suppose if people can live in cities with these kinds of contaminants in the air, you know, it can cause problems with people with pulmonary issues, and, you know, breathing matters and things that people have to deal with on a daily life. It's sort of like living in a major city at that point. But they said if it's prolonged exposure and it does continue, there is definitely need for people to be aware of that. And, you know, it can definitely cause some damage. They're continuing to monitor the situation and to see if the levels will be dropping. Hopefully they will be over time. But as of right now, that is what's going on. For health reasons, obviously, they're going to continue monitoring this for a very long time. They're going to continue to test water, continue to test the air. But for the moment, it looks like people are not in any immediate danger just because they are residing there. But stay vigilant on this and get your water tested if you're on a private water system.
Yeah, if you have your own well, definitely get your well water tested. Yep. Do you know how many derailments there were, train derailments in the U.S. in 2022?
Over 1,000, I think.
Yeah, 1,164.
That many.
Three a day, three every single day.
Yeah, it's part of a larger conversation about train safety. Yeah.
Yeah, so these are mostly minor. You know, obviously, it's not this kind of derailment, you know, every day. Most of them are in trail yards. They're mostly caused by human error. People screw up and they go off the track. And you know, and I think 14 people died. Oh, I'm sorry, 14 people were injured. One died in 2022 as a result of derailments. So, you know, that's why it's not major news all the time. But the issue has been that, especially since COVID, but also just to, you know, because of deregulation and maximizing profits, you know, the train cars are getting longer and longer, the larger number of cars being pulled at a time. And, you know, they haven't been forced to update some of the braking and safety measures. So there's definitely, you know, this is an opportunity to rethink the safety issues.
Mm-hmm. And is the infrastructure of the actual tracks, like, good? Is it being maintained or is it, like, super old?
Apparently it's good. Apparently the train tracks are good and they've been improved since, like, the 70s, 80s, et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's really not the issue. Again, the number one reason for derailments is user error, right? Is human error. Mm-hmm. The number two is broken rails, is physical error on the tracks themselves. And then, you know, obviously the train cars metal can fatigue. And I think that's what happened here probably. There was fatigue on one of the cars and it caused something to break. And that's obviously once one goes, the whole thing goes.
Yes, yes. There's video of a fire that occurred underneath one of the cars, and this was like 20 miles before the actual derailment.
Yeah.
But some, you know, a ring system caught video of it as the train was passing by, and one of the undercarriages of one of the cars was on fire.
Right. And that was another issue, like, why wasn't that picked up? Why couldn't they break in
detectors
time?
Detectors failed to, right.
Detectors, they don't have enough detectors. They're only required to have so many, and like every so many miles, et cetera. And anyway, so there's definitely going to be a pulse, I think, of regulation to try to nail this down until there's the next major accident, you know, and then we'll hand-wringing all over again. But overall, statistically, things are getting better. Obviously, there's still some issues. Okay, thanks, Evan. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. Okay.
It's an otter.
It's a sea creature. See?
Talking sea mammal.
Yeah.
It sounds like one of those old car alarms, you know, where they cycle through a bunch of different annoying noises.
Yes, 100 people wrote that one answer.
Yeah, right.
But it's clearly not a car alarm. It's like a dot matrix printer sounding like a car alarm.
Okay,
so. What is it? I'm so confused.
William Steele wrote in. He says, "Hi, Jay. Finally won a Who's That Noisy. My wife suggested that this week's noisy sounds like a home security alarm, maybe one that is a bit older." So, yes, like I said, the alarm, a lot of people wrote in car alarms and house alarms and things like that. It's not correct, but there's nothing there either. There's nothing. You're just wrong. But it's okay, you know, because things sound like other things. This is what I say about Who's That Noisy. So many things sound like so many other things. Another listener named Ed Mason wrote in and said, "Hey, Jay, this sounded to me to be similar to the encrypted messages that missile silo commanders would receive that would contain messages, the weather, or even the orders to launch the missiles." So basically he's saying, is it military, some form of military communication? That's a very interesting guess, but that is not correct. I'll move on to the next one. Benjamin Greenberg wrote in and said, "Hi, Jay, this week's noisy reminds me a bit of laser etching for metal items." He says, "However, I'm pulling a hard turn and saying it's military targeting systems."
Hmm.
Not correct, but very interesting guesses this week. And another person named Mike Todorovic said, "Jay, you legend, hope you are well. And is this week's noisy a dot matrix printer?" Oh my God. If a dot matrix printer made that noise, they would not have survived the 60s or 70s or whenever the hell people had used. I mean,
it made a pretty horrible noise, let's be honest.
But it wasn't that
horrible. It just didn't cycle like that. It was like one-fifth of that cycle. It was like the first noise.
Yeah, it was just, you're right. It wasn't like changing the horrible noise to another horrible noise. So the winner for this week, Stephen Liss, he writes in, "Having spent too many hours in one myself, that sounds very much like an MRI machine." And indeed, that is an MRI machine. Listen again. It's almost as if the person who designed the sounds for this thing said, "Let's make it as annoying as possible when people are stuck in this thing for hours."
Yeah.
I think the reason it didn't resonate for me is it sounds like that was recorded, I could be wrong, from outside the machine, not from inside the machine. And I don't think I've ever administered an MRI. I've only ever had one.
Yeah.
And what did you hear inside the machine?
It's the same. It's just way freaking louder. It's like in your brain.
Jeez.
Like it's so loud. You usually have to wear headphones in there. Or not headphones, earplugs.
Yeah, they're loud. And
they're so loud.
So many people wrote in basically telling me like why they recently had an MRI and, you know, what the experience was like. But yeah, you know, I mean, this is a piece of technology that when you need it, you need it. And most of us don't experience it, but many of us do. I have a new noisy this week, and this noisy was sent in by a listener named Benjamin Trey Blue, and here is the noisy. Okay, so it's that shrieking noise that you hear. Mm-hmm. That's the one I'd like to know. What is it? What the hell is that? Steve, you have any idea?
No.
Okay. Well, if you have an idea, you could email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thanks, Jay. Well, we have a great interview coming up with Derek Muller, Veritasium. So let's go to that interview now. We are joined now by Derek Muller. Derek, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And the listeners out there may know Derek as Veritasium, a very popular science and technology communicator on the internets, the YouTubes. And we're, you know, great to having you on the show. I've been watching your stuff for a long time. So tell us a little bit about your journey to becoming Veritasium. How did that end up being your career path?
Well, I think I always wanted to be some sort of creative person making videos or films or something like that. But it seemed like a terrible life choice. I mean, especially when I graduated back in the year 2000, I there were no careers in social media at that point. So I feel like I did the smart thing, and I studied engineering and physics at college, and then I went on to do a PhD at the University of Sydney. And like, I was trying to merge these passions in, you know, creative fields, performance, and stuff like that, and the sort of film side. I was trying to merge that with my interests in science. So the PhD was actually like, how do you make a film that will teach someone about physics? So that's what the PhD was, which, you know, now seems pretty relevant, but at the time, definitely seemed weird. Like, I was sort of painting myself into a corner there, because it didn't really seem like that would be an employable skill set. But yeah, I guess I got to a certain point in my life when I was like financially stable enough to just say, you know, I've been essentially working on backup plans up until the age of like 27 or 28. And that's when I said, like, you know, I can take a chance right now, and I can start making YouTube videos. So yeah, that's kind of how it got started, was just as this outlet for a desire to be creative and to, I guess, make videos that I thought were sort of meaningful or maybe helpful for people. So that's the goal. That's where it started.
So you actually have a PhD in making YouTube videos about science.
Well, at the time, YouTube didn't really exist. So it's just a PhD in how to make films to teach physics. Yeah, that's where it started.
What department was that in? Like, how did they do it at the University of Sydney?
Yeah. Interestingly, there was a movement that started, I want to say, like maybe 70s or 80s, where physics departments started taking on education. I think there's a couple reasons for that. One of them is because physicists are just like, we can do everything better than everyone else. So, you know, it's like, well, what do these education departments have that we don't? So the physicists started looking at their own teaching and like claiming that physics was like this unique domain where you needed unique skills and unique approaches to teach it. And so there was a whole field of research that began, and it's called physics education research. So when I saw that that was a possibility to join up with a physics education research group, you know, it felt like the perfect option for me to merge those interests in physics and film. So yeah, I was in the School of Physics. I was also co-supervised in like psychology and education. So yeah, cross-disciplinary.
And, you know, in your videos, of course, span a wide range of topics, you know, beyond physics and engineering. So can you walk us through a little bit of the process you go through in when you decide on, this is my next video, and then what do you do?
Yeah, I mean, every video is sort of a torturous process to figure out exactly how we're going to do it. I think, like, I've avoided just being a formulaic channel where it's like, well, in every video I just do a script and that's it, or something like, I hope that keeps things interesting for the audience. For me, it's just, I think it reflects my personal feeling that I don't like formulaic shows. I don't like formulaic movies. I don't like anything where there's like a single goal and like, you know, we want to throw the ring into the mountain or something and these guys want to stop us. Or anyway, like the stuff like that just doesn't appeal to me. So I'm always about doing something that sort of feels new and is sort of an adventure, and hopefully the audience doesn't really know where we're going and I don't really know where we're going either. So I would say each video is like, it's a big battle, and I think the ambition is to make the best video on that topic that is out there. That's always our goal. Whether we achieve it or not is another question. But it requires a lot of research, writing and thinking and talking to experts and just trying to get a handle on the topic in the best way that we possibly can. And then, you know, turn it into a YouTube video. I guess, like I feel like the process is just a mess. Like it's I feel like every video is a new battle, and it's probably not the best way to go about making a YouTube channel, but that's what we do.
You do what it takes, whatever that is. And you sort of have to
basically
go with it.
Yeah. Basically, I'm trying to think, like, we wanted to make a video on this, like, rods from God idea, like the US military idea of dropping tungsten sized telephone poles from space.
Ooh, yeah.
And they, you know, they would come in and hit the Earth at like Mach 3. And we kind of wanted to get an idea or, you know, get a sense of like how much energy is there in kinetic energy. And so our plan was to go out to the desert and, you know, load on as heavy steel weights as we could onto like a helicopter and drop them from as high as we could, you know, safely do so. That turned out to be a massive challenge. So, you know, I feel like I learn a lot, I guess, with every episode. But yeah, it's often about doing weird stuff like that.
Yeah, that one was fun. I like the fact that, because, you know, you could talk about that one specific thing, like how much energy is there in kinetic energy. But just that simple idea of we're going to drop rods from space onto stuff to damage it. There's so much physics involved, like, why tungsten? You know, how do things heat up when they fall into the atmosphere? And, you know, how do you target? There's a lot of physics on the way to looking at just the basic question of dropping stuff.
It's fascinating.
Totally. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, that also seemed like the most Mythbuster-inspired episode that you did.
Yeah, well, I mean, we were doing this episode, and someone on my team was like, "Should we contact Adam Savage and see if he wants to come?" And so we did, and he was game to come out. So, you know, that was another fun aspect of making that video. And of course, like, he had so many good ideas for what we should have done and how we should have planned it. You know, I still feel like we're rookies in a lot of ways. So we make a lot of rookie mistakes. And I think in that video in particular, we got roasted in the comments for like not being better prepared, but simply like pulling off, you know, what we were able to pull off was a real challenge. So yeah, everything's hard. And of course everyone wants to be a Monday morning quarterback and say like, oh, you should have done this. And it's like, yeah, we should have, but, it's not common for us.
Yeah,
to
you
have
try making
like
videos, buddy.
People. Yeah. Right. Let's see. Your channel.
Right.
Let's see your channel. 7 million views. Have you started any of these projects or explored anything, but you had to abandon it? You couldn't go through with it for whatever reason. Couldn't get to the end.
Yeah, I mean, there's all sorts of ideas, some of which, you know, I won't share because maybe they'll still come to fruition at some point. But, you know, some videos we get down the track and it's just not quite what we thought it was going to be, or it's not hitting the way we felt it would. You know, I would say in the early days of Make It Veritasium, like, the videos were short and easy and, you know, you make it in a day and it's no big deal. And so, you know, if you have one that's like not as good as you hoped it would be, you can still put it out there. It's no big deal. But now that the channel's got, you know, like 13.5 million subscribers, I feel like there's a certain pressure to make sure that the videos are all great. And so if you get to a point, even if we've invested, say, a month in research and writing and doing some animations and things, and recently I looked at one of these videos and I was like, well, it just doesn't hit, doesn't feel as strong as I think it needs to. And so we sort of, we can them sometimes, which is painful, but, you know, yeah. I think it's necessary.
When you approach a video, maybe now versus when you started, how much of your approach is trying to hack the algorithm, is trying to figure out exactly how you're going to make something that is going to, you know, generate clicks and generate revenue? And how much of it is this passionate, like, I am who I am, I'm making this for me and for who I think my core audience is, and, you know, you don't like it, market? Like, how do you find the sweet spot between those two things?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I feel like I've lived through a lot of shifts on YouTube. There's some like overarching shifts, like, you know, YouTube has pushed us essentially algorithmically to make longer videos. So, you know, you can plot out the length of my videos from the early days, and the average length goes from like 2 minutes up to over 20 minutes now. So, you know, that's one clear shift that we've made. And I would say, you know, how do we embrace that? Well, now we have to pick a video topic that deserves 20 minutes. So back in the day, you might just do something quick. I guess these days we would turn that into a short. So like, this is the new phase. I feel like the career of being a YouTuber is kind of like living in on sort of like shifting sands, and you have to keep moving one way or the other, you know, to keep your balance and to keep moving forward. I'd say there's been so many like shifts over the years. Like, the shift to watch time was a really important shift, which again drove that sort of longer content times. But I would say that other shifts, like, you know, people scrolling on mobile, like mobile becoming the main platform where people are watching the videos, and the fact that YouTube pre-rolls the first, you know, 5-10 seconds of the video or whatever, just as you're scrolling. So now we have to find ways of utilizing that first 5-10 seconds in a really effective way, as opposed to just saying, like, you know, putting up a sponsor card or doing something like that. So these days, I think we're very conscious about building out that first probably 30 seconds and making it like a sort of a sizzle for the whole video, so that if someone wants to get a sense of like, what is this video going to be, we try to like put that in the first 30 seconds. I think it's interesting how in that way we've shifted back to a TV type model, you know, where I know a lot of TV shows will like tease the whole show up front, right? So it's like we're rediscovering the same techniques to hook people on YouTube now. So definitely that's gone that way. You know, I would say, Kara, you raised the question of like, am I making these videos for me or am I making them for the algorithm? I would say, I think that trying to work within the YouTube system has made the videos better in a sense. Mm-hmm. I think it has forced me to grapple with some things. I mean, not always better, but I think like, because YouTube hopefully figures out what the audience wants and what audience like watching, if you try to make things that are good for the algorithm, hopefully they're also good for the audience. And that's not, again, it's not universally true, but I'd say like my pacing is picked up. My sense of storytelling, I think, has improved, and just the ability to, like, you know, really cut out the chaff and stuff like that. So I would say, like, a lot of those skills have been refined over 12 years of doing this. At the same time, I feel like sometimes it's just really hard to make videos. I mean, I think the hardest part of YouTube is maybe the title and thumbnail side of it, because we kind of have to regard that as equally important to the video, which is unfortunate from our perspective, because we just want to be great video makers and we want to make just a killer video. But the problem is, if no one clicks on that title and thumbnail, you're never going to get the view on the video. So it's like, because that is the gateway, we really struggle.
Yeah, it's interesting because, as you mentioned, like adjusting and in some ways bending to the algorithm is ultimately helping you refine your craft. But at the same time, you are still constrained by your foundational ethic of science content. So it's not like you're saying, okay, well, what does the best? I'm just going to do like a gaming video or a room review of like all of my stuff in my room or an unboxing video. Like, you're not switching your content. You're just refining within those parameters.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I would say, like, we also are drawn to topics that will make a good title and thumbnail or something that's really clear. For example, the video we just published was, like, World's Strongest Magnet. So I've done a lot of these sort of superlative titles over the years of, like, World's Roundest Object, World's Heaviest Weight, World's Highest Jumping Robot. And there's just something about those titles which is simple, clear, obvious, and compelling to, I think, a large audience. So yeah, we are drawn to some topics and maybe we struggle with others. Like, I would say a good example of one that we struggle with is like the fast Fourier transform, which is like, you know, if we can talk about why that's so important, I do think it's fascinating. And just how ubiquitous this sort of piece of mathematics is, but like the story of how it came to be is even more fascinating. But now how do you encapsulate that in a title and a thumbnail? That is a significantly more difficult challenge. And so yeah, I don't know. Like that video I made just because I wanted to make the video. And then later we were like, how do we package this? And later we're scrambling to try to make it palatable in 50 characters in an image.
So you can't just say, you won't believe hard. This and leave it up right, to the imagination yeah. of the viewer. I guess
yeah,
that
kinda... I mean, I think sometimes the clickbait like becomes anti-clickbait. Like mm-hmm. if you're so mm-hmm. far in that space of like, oh, you wouldn't believe what happens, or like, there's no way, you know, it's like just because it sounds so over the top, you actually lose yeah. people. And I think particularly this audience, which is like, you know, I think my audience is smart, intelligent, like sophisticated. Like I don't think, you know, some of the people who are watching other channels, I won't name names, but like a lot of the people who are watching that are like 13 or maybe not even 13 years old. So, you know, they're just like appealing to kids and appealing to that kind of click level. That's not our audience. And so we have to be a little bit more sophisticated and not too sort of exaggerating or sensationalist in the title and thumbnail to really, you know, get people in.
There's this side of psychology that I find so fascinating, which is like, why are people interested in the things they're interested in? And the other side of YouTube is exactly that. It's these bananas views on things that, like, to me, I just don't get why people are into it. But you have some insight into that because this is your world.
Yeah, I think to a degree. I would also say, like, and this is one of those really strange things of, like, living on this platform for 12 years, is, like, I've seen people come and go. Like, I've seen channels rise and fall. And partly, I attribute that to quirks in the algorithm. Like, I think that it's never going to be perfect, the algorithm. So, in a way, you think of, like, how is it working 5 years ago? Well, it was working kind of wrong 5 years ago, and it was strangely advantaging certain kinds of content and suppressing other kinds of content. So it's really strange to me to see how things have gone that way. Like, one of the earliest weird things about YouTube was, like, once you had subscribers, then views became kind of guaranteed, and your growth was, like, there was a real big positive feedback loop. So YouTube has had to combat that, and then sometimes I think they've gone too far, and so having, like, a big channel with a lot of subscribers actually kind of counts against you and acts as a weight. So, I don't know, they're constantly trying to balance all these factors. I don't know how you could make an algorithm that isn't subject to weird circular feedbacks. Like, you know, people who run YouTube will say, the algorithm is the audience. We are just representing what the audience wants. But the problem is, there's nearly infinite content, and the audience is oblivious to almost all of it.
Right.
So the algorithm has to show them something on that limited screen real estate. So what do you see? I don't know, 10, 20 videos? Okay, so now they've seen those things, and maybe they want to watch some of them. Okay, so now they want to watch those things, but they didn't know about the virtual infinity of stuff that was never shown to them. So immediately you get sucked into weird positive feedbacks like that. And I don't know that there's a way to break the cycle. From the creator perspective, what I can say is that if you want to grow and maintain an audience, it's sort of essential to have some viral hits. And the reason is you just need to become discoverable to people outside of your core sphere. Otherwise, your audience will kind of like dwindle and shrink down to nothing over time. So in my view, like, some viral hits are essential to sort of a long-term career on the platform.
And that's the trick, isn't it? You know, because like, and what is that formula? Nobody knows it.
About virality, I actually think there is a certain, I mean, like, some things are unexpected for sure, but I actually think there's some sort of clear principles that you can put in place to have a better chance of a viral hit than not. I think, like, from our perspective, videos that are really well researched and they're on topics that will surprise and delight people and really change the way they see the world, you know, if we can do that in a really nice way with great storytelling, I think, and a good title and thumbnail, you know, we'll have a pretty decent shot at getting a ton of views. So yeah, you know, it's not 100%, but there's definitely things you can do to improve your chances.
Yeah. Or you could say there are things that if you don't do it, you have no chance. You know, there's at least a minimum criteria that you need to hit, you know, before you could have a really totally popular video. But I think, and I wonder if we're getting to the point now where, you know, social media platforms like YouTube are so well established, they really are more like TV in a way, as you were saying, it's kind of merging towards that end of the spectrum. And having not all popular videos are necessarily viral. You know what I mean? Mm. It's not like just this quirky thing that goes out of control and nobody can understand why. It's that, yeah, you have a solid audience because you have good content and you put it out regularly and you develop your, you know, your regular audience. That's not really going viral. That's just having a really popular video, right?
That's true.
That exists now. It's not really just all random shit against the wall and some of it goes viral, you know, and most of it doesn't.
When I think about virality, I often think about sort of exceeding your normal audience by a large margin. So, you know, for us, a viral hit would have to be, you know, well over 10 million, maybe 20 million, 30 million. You know, that's sort of viral territory for us. Whereas if you're a channel with 50,000 views, you know, a video that gets 500,000 is viral. So, yeah, it all depends on like the base of subscribership and, you know, regular viewers.
Derek, thank you so much, God. It was great talking to you.
Yeah, man.
That was a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah. Good night.
That was Derek Muller, Veritasium, maker of the Veritasium Science and Engineering YouTube videos. If you haven't seen them, please do check them out. That is also an excerpt from a much longer interview that we did with Derek, which will become available soon to our premium members, so keep an eye out for that. All right, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Kind of a soft theme this week. There's just three news items, but they all involve improvements in technology. Are you ready?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. All right, here we go. Item number one. Engineers have developed concrete made from lunar regolith and ordinary potato starch and requiring only low temperature heating that is almost three times as strong as regular concrete. Item number two, aerospace engineers have made an airplane propeller blade design that significantly reduces noise while increasing thrust and efficiency by 20% over traditional design. And item number three, scientists report a new process for electrosynthesis of multi-carbon products from CO2 that is twice as efficient as existing methods. Jay, go first.
All right, this first one, engineers have developed concrete made from lunar regolith and ordinary potato starch, and it requires low temperature heating.
So in other words, three times you can cook it like in an oven, you know, not you don't need like super high temperatures.
And it's three times as strong as regular concrete. I mean, right out of the gate, this thing seems like fiction to me.
Is it stronger on the moon compared to the Earth?
No, objectively, it's stronger.
I just don't see how it's three times stronger. I mean, why would it be three times stronger? Why would in potato starch? That's just very odd. The second one, aerospace engineers have made an airplane propeller blade design that significantly reduces noise and increased thrust efficiency by 20%. You'd think that more thrust would mean more noise.
Yeah, that's
but I could see. Yeah, I could see this being science, though. And the third one, scientists report a new process for electrosynthesis of multi-carbon products from CO2.
What?
That's twice as fast. Yeah, so neither of these, so two and three don't seem
so I'll tell
that
you,
crazy
the
to me.
Multi-carbon products are basically like making fuel, right? From making high energy carbon, you know, hydrocarbons out of CO2 from the atmosphere, right? That's the idea.
Oh, this is cool. Okay.
Yeah, that's cool, but again, you know, would it ever scale up and all the things that make these types of advancements not go anywhere. But some scientists report that there's this new process that they can make fuel from. This happens all the time. I'm not surprised about that. So I think I'm just going to go with my gut and say that the first one, the potato starch and lunar regolith, are not going to be made with low temperature, and they're not going to be three times as strong as regular concrete. That's got to be fiction.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, the last two sound reasonable, and the regolith, I agree with Jay, just tweaks me a little bit more than the other ones, although nothing would surprise me with these. But yeah, I'll go with the regolith as well. Fiction.
Okay, Evan?
I suppose so. It's just so bizarre. and how much lunar regolith do we have, and how much are you using to test this kind of stuff? I mean, it must be such a small amount super tiny. So I'm wondering
or they made an analog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they may have used simulated regolith in the study.
What? Wait a minute. At the concrete made from lunar regolith. Doesn't you're saying possibly synthetic regolith?
Close enough.
Yeah, simulated. I'm saying it could be simulated regolith. But the point is that it predicts that that's what it would be. That's what the properties would be with actual regolith.
Well, yeah, whereas the other two have a patina of, what, plausibility. This one's got nothing to it, this regolith and potato starch. All right, I'll go with the guys. I'll say that one's fiction.
Okay, and Kara?
I have no idea why I went last here. I think that was a fluke because I know nothing about any of this shit.
No, it's just because you went first last time.
Cool. Yeah, I'm like, I have no knowledge of any of this. I got to go with the guys because otherwise I would not be, that would be a bad gamble. So I'm going with the guys.
All right, so you're all going with the first one. So we'll take this in reverse order. I'll start with number three. Scientists report a new process for electrosynthesis of multi-carbon products from CO2 that is twice as efficient as existing methods. You all think that is science, and that one is science. This is a nice solid though, huh? Incremental advance. Yeah, so generally, the process they use catalysts in either a neutral or alkaline environment. So they said, let's try it in a strong acid environment. And they were able to get twice the efficiency. So it's the overall energy efficiency is 25%, which is a twofold improvement over the previous benchmark. And they're able to make these multi-carbon molecules, right? Basically, the catalyst causes carbon-carbon coupling, right? Once you have that, then you could build sort of these hydrocarbons. And also molecules that feed into many industries are basically high energy compounds, right? That feed into many different industries. So it is sort of this is the holy grail of carbon capture, right? You make it into, because carbon dioxide's a low energy molecule, right? You get energy out of it by combining it with oxygen. And then we want to reverse that process in order to put it back into a high energy molecule. And the more efficiently we can do that, the better, because obviously if it takes a lot of energy to capture carbon, it's kind of counterproductive, right? So any improvement is good. So yeah, I would consider this an incremental technological improvement, but solid, you know, twice doubling of efficiency there is very nice. Let's go back to number two. Aerospace engineers have made an airplane propeller blade design that significantly reduces noise while increasing thrust and efficiency by 20% over a traditional design. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is the fiction.
Damn it.
Sorry, guys.
Damn.
This
would be massive if true. Like, this is just exaggerated. I mean, the 20% thrust efficiency, that's massive. But here's the situation, a little bit of background. There's traditionally a trade-off between noisiness and efficiency when it comes to propeller design. The more efficient you make them, the more noisy they are, and the less noisy they are, the more efficient they can be. And that seems counterintuitive because you would think that noisiness is a sort of inefficiency in and of itself. But it has to do with the fact that if you know how propellers could have two blades, an old plane might have two blades, or it might have three blades, or it could have four, or it could have six blades, right? As long as they balance each other. So the more blades you have, the less noisy the propeller, but the less efficient it is as well. And so there's this trade-off in blade design for propeller planes between efficiency and noisiness. And so there was a recent study where they were trying to say, all right, is there a sweet spot? Can we do anything to sort of maximize efficiency without having to have like super noisy planes? Now that the noise level is significant because obviously for passengers, and I don't know, I'm sure you guys at some point in your lives have rode in a commercial propeller plane, a prop plane, right? They're freaking noisy. It's like bang the whole time you're riding the plane.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, awesome. They're significantly noisy. And that's even, you know, making that's the compromised noise level. That's not even the maximum noise level, because you know what I'm saying? But what they found was that when you have more blades, it disrupts the vortices at the end of the blades. And that's where a lot of the noise comes from. It's the blade tip vortices. So More blades, because just the flow of the air around them reduces the blade tip vortices. And so more blades are there. That's why they're less noisy, but they're also less efficient. So what they found was that they could alter, they basically did a study to see if we alter the design of the tips of these propeller blades, can we reduce the noise and also stay within sort of the sweet spot for efficiency? And so they were able to create a blade that has a significant, like multi-decibel reduction in noisiness with only a small hit in efficiency. So it was actually, it still reduced the efficiency. It didn't even increase it at all, let alone by 20%, which is like mind-boggling. But it was only by a little bit. So like, we could maintain our efficiency basically with like a 3% hit, but significantly reduce the noise. That was the breakthrough. And so yeah, the 20% I thought was big enough to justify, you know, a fiction. The reason why there were still studying, you know, propellers, you know, in 2023, you know,
good question. Was it the because, interior of a jet engines? Well,
because no, these are propellers for propeller propelled planes.
Oh, because of the battery electric planes.
Yes, because of electric planes. Because if we want to have electric propeller planes for short to medium distance commercial routes, we want them to be as efficient as possible and as quiet as possible, because they also will, it's not just for the passengers. They could be flying low over residential areas, et cetera. You know, we want to reduce the environmental noise that they would generate as well. So it's very important to make sure we're optimizing blade design for those two features. Okay. Let's go back to number one. Engineers have developed concrete made from lunar regolith and ordinary potato starch and requiring only low temperature heating that is almost three times as strong as regular concrete. This one is science. Now, I'm actually not sure if they used simulated regolith from the moon or not. I know that they used simulated Mars regolith because we don't have any.
Right.
And they specifically say they had to simulate the Mars regolith, but they just said they used lunar regolith and without specifically saying if it was simulated or it were a sample from the moon. So I'm not sure, but it could have been. That's why I said it could be simulated. I don't know. But what they found was when they went through a process where they combine starch from, could be from many different sources, but potatoes apparently work the best. They combine that with the simulated Mars regolith or the lunar regolith, and whether or not it's simulated. And then they compress it, they heat it, and they compress it some more, and you get a really good concrete. You know, the starch becomes a very effective binder. The regolith is a good substrate. You get this sort of biocomposite, you know, and they tested it, and it had, the Mars regolith had about twice the compression strength, the lunar regolith about a little bit less than three times the compression strength, and they also had greater, they call it flexural strength. So they had greater compression strength and flexural strength for both. Now, the same people, their previous study, they looked at making concrete from the blood and piss of astronauts.
And why the blood?
That worked too, because they want they wanted the nitrites or something from the urine and some kind of protein from the blood as a binder, maybe the albumin, I don't know. And it worked. It worked, but they said, but you know, that's the limit, the supply of astronaut blood may be limited. And so we need an alternative binder. So that's why they did this follow-up study for using basically food starch. Now they call their product Starcrete, which is interesting. Starcrete. Obviously, the idea would be if we have a settlement on the moon, and we're growing our own food there, that you could have like the waste products of the food could be used as a source for starch, which could then be used as a local building material. Really strong concrete, which would be nice.
Right. Yeah. So these people watched The Martian or read The Martian,
Totally. Yeah. And it would work on Mars as well. You know, which is awesome. It would make, they said if you had a kilogram of the starch, a kilogram, you could make about 250 bricks. So that's not a lot for a kilogram. So it's you know, it's not the kind of thing where we're going to be shipping the starch to the moon, although you could do it for some starter, I guess, you know, for some of it. It's really intended for you're growing it locally, right? You're using it from as a byproduct of the food production that's supporting the settlement. You can also have starch to build stuff out of it, which is obviously a good idea. We definitely want to build as much as we can out of local material when you're on the moon or Mars, because shipping stuff there is ridiculously expensive and limited. So yeah, it's pretty amazing. And the thing is, it works so well, why not use it on Earth? It's just potato starch, and even like the simulated Martian regolith, which is obviously made of stuff from Earth, was still stronger than regular concrete, still twice as strong, you know. So
what was so special about the regolith? Was it like, would it work with dirt?
I don't know. I mean, I guess so, but I mean, they you know, just the physical characteristics of it.
Right.
What lent itself to this. They want the, and it wasn't, they weren't looking for the best substrate. They wanted to know, will this work on the moon? Will this work on
right.
Mars? So,
yeah,
yeah. So interestingly, I guess they could, somebody could say, okay, let's take the same concept and just try to find the best substrate on Earth.
Mm-hmm.
You, whatever that would be, abundant, cheap, and also strong. And it, and the, I think what they really discovered was that food starch is a really good concrete binder, you know, if you have the right substrate with it. And so, the key is, and this is not to be glossed over, is that you can make this concrete with oven temperature heating, right? With low temperature
yeah.
heating. You don't need like don't these need thousands of degrees that are necessary to make concrete. So, you know, we make the concrete out of lime and you have to heat that, which releases the CO2. And also you have the energy that you need to heat it to whatever it is, like 2,000-3,000 degrees. So this was just, you know, cooking at oven temperature. They also said that if you add a little bit of salt, that
tastes
makes
good.
It even, it makes it a little bit stronger, the salt. And they said we could source, get this, we could source the salt from the tears of astronauts.
Come on. What are we doing here?
Because it just takes a pinch of salt.
Oh my gosh.
So you have to make the astronauts cry.
Blood, blood, tears, and sweat.
Right, yeah.
Blood, sweat.
I guess sweat might work too.
Funny.
I think they're crying. They're crying because they came all this way just to build a bunch of shit out of concrete.
Right.
Very depressing to me. I don't want us to build things out of concrete on the moon.
Sure we should. Why not?
Oh, my God.
I can't care.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
This week's quote was offered up by a listener, Jason from Sydney. Thank you so much. Here is the quote. The scientific revolution has not been a revolution of knowledge. It has been, above all, a revolution of ignorance. The great discovery that launched the scientific revolution was the discovery that humans do not know the answers to their most important questions. And that was written by Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote the book Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind, which he says we probably already know and read, and sadly know. But now add that to my list of books to read.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he says he's making the point that the scientific revolution was one where cultures had a revelation, an admission of our own ignorance of nature, and we had to discover it, that it wasn't already in the texts that were already written.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
Right? Admitting your ignorance is the first step, you know, to discovery, to knowledge.
Right.
First comes insight, then comes action.
Yeah. Yep. And not only that, the more we, you know, you always have to separate knowledge into, you know, three places. There's the known knowns, the known unknowns, and the unknown unknowns. And what happens is, as our knowledge grows, the known unknown category grows. And mm-hmm. so but our ignorance grows as we get more knowledge, in a way, mm-hmm. right? And that's a good thing, because that's...
Or at least our awareness of it.
Yeah. So the known unknowns is you know, where most advances are happening. But the other way to look at this is that the bigger shift is from the unknown unknowns to the known unknowns. Knowing what we don't know is the more important shift than to the known knowns. You know what I mean? Because if you're not aware that you don't know something, that's ignorance, is not even knowing that you don't know something.
Right, because you can't do much about that.
Right. And yet it gives you the illusion of knowledge, which is the worst, which is dangerous.
Yes. Dunning-Kruger the shit out of everything, man.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. Plenty of that going on.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Surely.
Hey, man. Thank you.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.